This episode of China Money Podcast is sponsored by Lehman Brown, a China accounting, audit, and advisory firm. Golden Gate, a law firm providing a full range of legal services in China. Covert Limited, a leading internet privacy tool. And 51mice.com, a comprehensive online platform for meetings, incentives, conferences, and exhibitions in China. Please go to our website, chinamoneynetwork.com, and click on our sponsors links. Thank you so much, everyone, for your support. Hello, everyone. Welcome to China Money Podcast. I'm your host, Nina Xiang. Our guest today is Jonathan Larson, Chief Innovation Officer at Ping An Insurance Group Company Limited and the CEO of Ping An Global Voyager Fund, a US dollar $1 billion corporate venture capital fund launched in May by the Chinese insurance giant to invest in innovative fintech and healthcare companies globally. Mr. Larson spoke to China Money Network last month and explained in great detail on how he plans to deploy the $1 billion capital and what types of innovation and technology that he is most interested in investing. We had an extensive conversation covering a wide range of topics. You can continue to listen to our Q&A here or go to our website at chinamoneynetwork.com to check out the written Q&A, a video interview, and much more. Here is our conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Hello, Jonathan. Welcome to China Money Podcast.
Thank you, Nina. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So you joined Ping An in May. You come from the background of consumer and retail banking. Now you are the Chief Innovation Officer for Ping An and also the CEO of the Global Voyager Fund, the $1 billion venture capital fund for the group. So what has been the biggest change?
Well, it's quite interesting. As you know, for the last 4.5 years, I had been running the global retail bank for Citigroup, based in Hong Kong, but including all of the businesses in retail around the world. And I guess front to back office, I had about 80,000 people working for me one way or another.
80,000.
So it's a big change to come to a very small team. In fact, the first day I had my assistant and me, and that was it. At Ping An. So even though Ping An itself is a huge organization with, I think, 325,000 people right now and 1.2 million life insurance agents, so it's a massive company. But our fund is new, and you know, we're starting from scratch. Building our team very deliberately. So just the scope of people management is completely different. The nature of the role is different but complementary. Obviously, when I was at Citi and I was involved very much in the company's innovation agenda, and we absolutely had quite a lot of interaction with new generation technology-based companies in the fintech space. So I was relatively familiar with the domain, but obviously that's my primary focus in this role, as opposed to running a very large set of businesses. So it's a very welcome change, and it's very energizing to come into a new domain with a very different mission and a very different agenda.
How you have two roles. How are these two roles different and overlap, perhaps?
Great. So the first role is to be the Chief Innovation Officer for Ping An overall. That in itself is quite a daunting task. The truth of the matter is Ping An is already a very innovative company, Peter Ma really is the Chief Innovation Officer, I must say. I'm here to try and help Ping An continue to innovate, to continue to find new opportunities with the existing business that they have, to continue to find new technologies, new platforms, and new approaches that can be integrated into their business, as well as to find new businesses both in China and internationally. So the innovation role, in a sense, is a much broader role than the role of the Ping An Global Voyager Fund. The fund, you can think of it as one of the levers for driving innovation in Ping An. It's about making investments in companies that have distinctive technologies, platforms, and models that either have already achieved success or we think have the promise to achieve success, but which also have strategic relevance for Ping An, either for an existing business or a new business. So it's an investment.
Can we think about this fund as a corporate venture capital fund?
It is a corporate venture capital fund. Our objective is strategic. We want to use the alignment that we can achieve through a minority investment in a company that is interesting to us, and use that to create the alignment to be able to create some form of partnership that's going to be helpful to our business.
So this fund is actually one of many levers, as you describe it, for the group's innovation drive. I know there's multiple other levers, and how would you describe the coordination between among all these different initiatives in the group?
Well, in some ways, you can think of it as a marketplace for ideas. Ping An is... I think we've got 30 businesses at last count at the first level within the organization. It runs with a very high level of autonomy within each business. So we have empowered leaders. We couple that with a very disciplined KPI system. It's one of the most disciplined KPI systems I've ever seen in my career. So I think it's a very good combination.
How so?
Well, it's very detailed, very rigorous, and there's very systematic
follow-up.
How
many KPIs?
It depends on the business, but you know, every leader quite deep into the organization has a very specific set of KPIs that drive what they need to deliver, and they really do need to deliver them. So,
well, give us an example for the Global Voyager Fund. What's your key KPI?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I think I'm the only person in the company, apart from the chairman, that actually doesn't have any KPIs.
Oh,
my agenda
you.
Is much more open, okay. And deliberately so. So that's an interesting aspect of the role as well, as an aside. But the important point is that in Ping An, we've got empowered business leaders. So we have this combination of empowerment and operating discipline. So innovation comes from bottom up and from within. It comes from strategic partnerships. It comes from ideas that we generate at a group level that can then be injected into the businesses or strapped across the businesses. And it comes from the kinds of partnerships and opportunities that we are surfacing and creating through the Global Voyager Fund.
When is this fund established, and what are the LP mix?
Okay.
Or is it completely 100% Ping An capital?
It's entirely Ping An capital. We set up the fund pretty much when I joined.
So in May?
In May. And we're actively investing as we speak, so we're off and running.
So when you set up the fund, did it require government approval from Beijing, because this is considered an offshore investment platform?
Yeah, so the fund is using capital that Ping An already has overseas, so it's completely compliant with the foreign exchange requirements and any other approvals that are required for deploying capital internationally.
So the fund was established in May. I've heard that in August there is a new requirement by the Chinese government that any offshore investment platforms would require government approval. So I guess the fund was set up before then, so it didn't need the the approval.
Yes,
at that
time. And look, as the environment evolves, obviously we'll make sure we're fully compliant with any approval requirements.
Okay, so now, the two focus areas for this fund you have talked about before include health tech and also fintech. Let's first talk about fintech. What are some specific areas in this sector that you're most optimistic about?
Well, with the view to strategic access that I mentioned, and the idea that we want to find platforms, technologies, and business models that we can make use of within Ping An, either in China or internationally, and it could be either existing businesses or new platforms or white spaces that we don't participate in just yet. Given the range of Ping An's businesses in financial services, it's quite a broad spectrum that we're looking at. So as you know, Ping An has the broadest range of financial licenses and indeed businesses of any company in China in the financial sector. And part of the value of Ping An is the spectrum of businesses and the ability to bring a very broad range of services to an individual client. So as we look out, we say, okay, are there innovations in any of those business areas? The answer is there's quite a lot of innovation. There's about 7,000 or 8,000 fintech companies in the world today, so there's an awful lot of innovation going on. We then say, okay, what's going to be most interesting? And typically we apply three lenses. We say, where is the most impactful innovation happening? Where is that innovation likely to unlock real value? All innovation is not equal. And thirdly, what is going to give the most leverage and be most relevant to Ping An? So there could be areas where, for example, for regulatory reasons, something that looks like a really good opportunity internationally may be a less relevant opportunity in China. Look, it could be something to do with there's a lot of innovation in the international remittances area, for example. Now, obviously, China has currency controls, and not all of the remittance products that we see in the United States or in Europe or the UK, could simply be applied in a direct way. So that limits that opportunity somewhat. Some of them can be adapted, but not applied in full form. So it somewhat limits the opportunity. That would be one example.
Could you give us a couple examples of some type of investment or startups or technology that fits all those criteria you just described?
Well, I'll tell you about the first deal that we've just announced, which is an investment in a company called 10X Future Technologies, run by Anthony Jenkins, set up in the last 2 years by him and his team. Anthony, of course, is the former CEO of Barclays, and he has some 30 years' experience, including at Citi, as well as at Barclays. I think are the two main organizations he's worked for in his life, including very extensive experience in retail banking and credit cards over the years. Anthony is one of the real thought leaders in the banking industry today, and he's talked about the Uber moment of banking. And what he's really talking about is the time being ripe where the technology is now here, consumer expectations are ready for banks to go digital and to overhaul their legacy models. What's very interesting is that when you're a large-scale bank, typically you're going to have a technology stack that includes many layers of legacy technology components. And that is firstly expensive. Secondly, when you need to change that stack, when you need to interface it to new social network channels, for example, or when you want to introduce e-commerce to it, the change process is quite complicated and it takes a lot of time. In addition, the whole stack is far more expensive than if you were to redesign the stack using contemporary technology. So what Anthony has said is it possible to rethink what it takes to build a bank using contemporary tools, using APIs, using a data lake construct that allows structured and unstructured data to be kept in one place, having something called a product writer that allows you to simply create a product using exactly the same interest calculation, fee calculation, and other parameters across all of the products. So you don't have to have separate platforms for separate products within a bank. Process writers that use what are called 5GL tools to use drag and drop tools to be able to actually define a process as opposed to having to do that manually today.
Wow.
And then having interfaces that allow AI applications to be bolted in through APIs very simply to access this data lake, either for real-time transaction analysis or for static data analysis. So.
Sounds awfully complex.
Probably more detail than you want to hear about. But what we saw with Anthony and with 10X is really a breakthrough platform. And I know from my experience at Citi and in the marketplace that there are very few people who've really thought through what the next generation is for these banking technology platforms. And we know there are dozens of banks around the world who are looking at $500 million or $1 billion-plus replacement costs for end-of-life technologies that they have today. So we feel that this is a really great example of, a piece of core componentry where contemporary technology and essentially a digital mindset allows you to radically change the infrastructure, essentially do 10 times more for the customer at a tenth of the cost. So that's our first investment. We announced it, I think, 3 weeks ago with Anthony.
Yes.
We hope it's going to, of course, be successful, but we're quite excited about it.
What is the strategic part of this investment?
Well, Ping An, we have our own bank. We have Ping An Bank.
So Ping An could potentially.
So we also have a very interesting business called Ping An One Connect. And Ping An One Connect is a business that tries to leverage capabilities we've built within Ping An, but make them available to other players within the China market. So in this particular case, we have about 200 banks that are part of One Connect. And some of these banks are quite large. They could be well over a trillion RMB in balance sheet. Some of them are much smaller. All of them are looking at the technology landscape in China, which we all know is very advanced. And these banks are saying, how can we ever compete with the Ant Financials or the Tencents of this world? So Ping An is now saying, well, we can help you. We can give you mobile technology that you can just plug in. It's possible that we could take the 10X platform and make that part of our core componentry. We haven't made final decisions about any of this just yet, mm-hmm. but that's a very clear example of how we could deploy the 10X type of model, you know, within our business system, either in our direct business in Ping An Bank or within our partner business in One Connect.
How many companies have you talked to that basically how many companies you have talked to for investment investigation purposes?
I can tell you exactly how many. It's about 250 so far.
Okay.
In 5 months.
And you chose one. You made one.
That's our first one. We have a very robust pipeline.
Okay. Well, can you describe just give us, you know, two examples of, you know, companies that you are likely to invest, or at least you feel optimistic about?
Of course I can't do that, because they're all confidential.
It doesn't have to talk about the company's names, technology idea?
No, absolutely. I can give you some examples of generic technologies. What I can tell you is that there's a very wide spectrum of potentialities out there, and we look at a lot of companies, and we're very interested in only just a few. So I think we're very selective. We see a lot of overvaluation, so we try and steer clear of that.
I'm sorry, do you invest mostly in non-Chinese companies or both Chinese and overseas?
Our focus is global, and our primary purpose is to look outside China to find leading platforms that we can then bring to China.
And the overvaluation... is still something that stands out to you, especially for someone come from China, where the overvaluation perhaps is the most severe.
Yeah, let's just say that overvaluation is not unique to China.
Okay.
So we have to be selective. We often see companies that we really like, actually, and we just see the price point to be unjustifiable from our perspective. And look, it may well be justifiable from somebody else's, so I make no judgment about the inherent value of the company.
Okay.
But as we look at it, when we do our analysis, we look at the partnership opportunity, we look at the standalone value, mm-hmm. you know, we struggle to get to the numbers. And in those cases, generally, it does not make sense for us to invest.
Okay.
So we're very, very selective. But look, we're very interested in the whole revolution in personal and business lending platforms that has taken place around the world, in particularly the US, UK, and Europe in the last 5 or 6 years. So there are many such platforms. Some of them are already very mature. Some are less so. Some represent interesting entry point investment opportunities. Some do not. We're very interested...
You mean personal and business lending? Do you mean like P2P platforms?
It could be P2P platforms, or it could be platforms that use wholesale funding but lend online.
Okay.
Absolutely. So that area is something that continues to interest us. We're interested in model innovations in that area. Certainly continuing to monitor, you know, quite a number of players in that space. So that's an area of interest for us. We're very interested in the whole insurtech space. We think that insurance is definitely going to experience fundamental changes in delivery technology over the next 3 to 5 years. When you think of the Most insurance companies are relatively backwards in terms of technology adoption. Ping An, by the way, is quite advanced in technology adoption within its insurance business. So, for example, we have very good telematics in our auto insurance business. 90% plus of our underwriting doesn't touch human hands, is automated. We have very good online platforms. We have very good sales platforms for our agents and so forth. But there are some really interesting innovations taking place in insurance, on-demand insurance, low price point insurance for things like home, for theft insurance, for personal accident insurance, for travel insurance. How do you take the spectrum of risks that a normal person faces and allow people to activate, switch on or off at a reasonable price point on demand when that risk protection is needed, as opposed to having to pay for it all of the time? So we're seeing quite a lot of innovation in that area in multiple geographies. We're looking closely at whether there are some players that could be interesting for us in that space.
Oh, could you explain a little bit on on-demand insurance? As we know, you can't drive on the road and buy a car insurance after you had a car accident. So obviously it's probably a bad example, but how does that work?
Well, obviously you can't insure something after the risk has already been crystallized. that would be fraud.
That's a terrible example.
It's actually but it's an interesting point. It's one of the challenges that some of the players in the on-demand insurance space have faced. So if you insure your iPhone and then you break the screen, then of course you're entitled to be reimbursed if indeed that risk is covered. If you break the screen and then you say, well, why don't I get insurance? And then I'll tell them that the screen was broken after I got insurance, and that becomes fraud. So how you manage that is actually a very important point, and it's not that easy. So insurances that can be very easily switched on and off, being able to understand when the insurance was activated versus when the event happened is a very fundamental point. But travel insurance, I think, would be the best example. You need it when you need it. Most people forget to get it because there's no convenient way of just switching it on and off, or even having it automatically activated when you leave the country, for example, right? Because your cell phone knows when you leave the country. Why couldn't that just trigger travel insurance, as needed?
Very interesting. So now let's move on to health tech.
Yeah.
Similarly, what specific areas in this market are you looking at?
Very, very interesting set of opportunities. Health is one of the biggest opportunities Ping An faces. We, of course, have our own health insurance business in China. We also have a business called Good Doctor, which is the largest telemedicine platform in the world with 140 million users. So it's of a massive scale. We have 500,000 users per day consulting our doctors within Good Doctor. We're also very active in working with municipalities in China in the government health insurance space. And in particular, government and health insurance represents something like 50% of total health spending in China. And we're working with municipalities, about 200 of them, to assist with fraud control, with payment processing, and we see many future possibilities for that business as well. We also have a clinic enterprise business that supports about 30% of the clinics in China, and a number of other elements to our sort of health ecosystem. I think the general summary of what we're trying to do in health is trying to use technology to deliver health services cost-effectively and to help manage population health cost-effectively. So around the world, we're seeing a lot of very interesting innovation. So we have Good Doctor, but in the US and in the UK and a number of other markets, we see different versions of telemedicine platforms that share some elements with Good Doctor, but in some cases have complementary elements. The use of AI, for example, for diagnostic triage is quite an interesting area. The use of AI for clinical pathing to help the physicians shape the treatment path. The use of wearables and the use of mobile technology for adherence monitoring or for follow-up post-consultation is quite interesting. The area of imaging is very interesting. So we're seeing the technology of being able to diagnose x-rays for chests or for head or for heart becoming quite sophisticated. Still got some way to go, but it's at the point where it's investable, at least right now, and is very close to being commercializable on a large scale. So that's a very exciting area for us as well.
But for Ping An Good Doctor, for example, the challenge for this type of health mobile app companies is that after a year or two of attracting massive amount of users, people start to realize that it's really difficult to monetize it. So that's why, you know, venture capital firms have all sort of cooled down on this sector, on this type of investment. Mm-hmm. What's your thinking on, you know, for Good Doctor, how do they make money, and if making money is actually important for Ping An?
Yeah, well, I think it's a much broader conversation about Good Doctor itself, but I think that firstly, to create a 140 million user base and 500 users per day, that's a fairly significant achievement in itself. And if you look at the history of digital businesses, the market has been willing to reward businesses that are able to achieve massive scale like that well ahead of revenues in many, many examples in China and elsewhere in the world. Many of those examples have gone on to be, you know, super productive revenue businesses. So I think that there are many channels for delivering revenue as that business is shaped. We're seeing examples in the UK where a telemedicine platform can actually be used as part of the government health insurance program, where it actually is reimbursable by the government health insurance platform. So that's one way of monetizing and, you know, having some way of allocating the reimbursement from a government health insurance or even a private health insurance program between the doctor and the platform. New Zealand, for example, right now is using a US-based company called HealthTap to build in telemedicine as part of its national health delivery strategy.
So government orders or government...
Absolutely. And okay. So, you know, if you can deliver the same consultation at, let's say, two-thirds the cost or one-third the cost using video or chat versus actually having someone come and see a doctor in a public hospital, that's clearly a far more cost-effective solution. And what we find is that combined with digital triage, 50% of the patients don't need to see a doctor at all if you have a very good triage engine to begin with. So from the government's perspective, it works out to be a very cost-effective solution. All the way through to charging directly, we see models in the US where platforms such as Good Doctor are able to charge directly for patients and are able to recover costs, or the patients are able to recover costs through private health insurance. So there are many models. Obviously, there are product sales that can go with consultations for a user base as large as we have in Good Doctor. Obviously, there are advertising opportunities and so forth. So I think there are quite a few revenue levers that will come into play over time.
So you've talked with 250 companies. You've already listed all the criteria you're looking for in these companies. But what are the things that click with you? That what, you know, what's the most important for you to make the investment decision to actually, you know, inject capital into a company? Is it, you know, the technology? Is it the synergy with the company?
Look, in terms of criteria, the most important thing is what can move the needle at Ping An? What can be relevant and powerful to transform Ping An's franchise? That could be in a single business within our ecosystem, or it could be something that straps across. If it's an AI technology, if it's a voice processing technology or an image technology, typically it will have the potential to support one business. It could also have the potential to be a generic enabler across many challenges across, many channels across many businesses. So the first and most important criterion is, you know, is this business, its technology, its platform, can it be useful to us? Can it be a powerful enabler? If it doesn't meet that criterion, then we're not going to spend a lot of time on it. because there are dozens of investment opportunities out there. For us, return is important, of course. We want to deploy money efficiently and get a fair return, hopefully a very good return. But the overriding rationale is strategic relevance. So that's the first thing we look for. Generally, we're not interested in very early stage companies as a direct investment opportunity. Typically, early stage companies go through a few pivots. We'd rather deal with them once they've gone through those pivots.
So usually each round?
Well, typically we want to see companies that are 3 to 7, 3 to 10 years old. We want them to have a product. We want them to have clients. We'd like them to have a path, a revenue base, however small. We would like them to have a path to profitability that we can reasonably easily define. We want them to have stable and mature management. We'd like them to have gone through all of those teething challenges that you go through typically in the first 3 years already. There might be some exceptions to that, but in general, that's our stance. So that's very important to us. We definitely need to see a path to financial viability over time. That doesn't mean it has to be immediate or even in the first 2 or 3 years, but we definitely have to be able to place some kind of value. The idea would have to be, if it weren't possible to place a financial value on the future cash flows, the idea would have to be at an order of magnitude of power as an idea for us to want to actually put money against it. So I think the ability to value future profitability is very, very important for us. Of course, we want to be dealing with leaders that we think can really build a business. That's probably ultimately the most important ingredient. You know, do you have the tenacity, the vision, the intellect, the drive to create something that's completely new and that really changes the landscape? They're the kind of companies we want to invest in.
Well, let's talk about AI, artificial intelligence specifically. You mentioned briefly before on AI's application in health tech.
Yep.
But just across all the different sectors, even including real estate, car insurance,
sure,
and all the other sectors you already covered, what are the most promising applications of AI that you see right now?
Well, I think we've seen a lot of good applications in image recognition. Already, I think that's quite well advanced. 15 years ago, we used to call OCR AI. We don't call it AI anymore. We just call it OCR. It's available for free on Google, and for any document you want translated into text. We now have voice to text and text to voice functionality that's fairly freely available from people like IBM Watson, from Google, from a whole bunch of sources, Baidu, etc. We have on the image side, I think in the last couple of years we've made pretty good progress in facial recognition. Ping An has actually been a leader in this itself, and we've got quite good internal facial recognition capabilities.
And voice print recognition as well.
We've got both. We use facial for logging into Ping An online sites, for example. If you get a loan from us through our Puhua business, then we'll match your face against a government database of faces. So we can really use that to effectively eliminate identity fraud in combination with other variables. So that's quite a powerful capability, and that's absolutely built on our AI capabilities and our AI resources. So that's very positive. More generally, I think we've seen very good advances in language translation, particularly in the last year or so. And working for a Chinese company, it's quite interesting. I of course, have translators, but I'm heavily dependent upon language translation tools as well, just to get quick translations of things. And when I translate using either Google or Baidu, from Chinese to English, I'm quite surprised at how much you can get out of the translation. You can sort of get to 90-95% of the meaning now. So we now have a lot of these ingredients. I think when you look at financial services and health, there's almost an infinite number of potential use cases out there that could be really valuable. We've clearly seen decent advances in fraud analysis using AI techniques or machine learning techniques, credit analysis, which we're involved with obviously very extensively. I think there's going to be a lot of good AI applications in interactive voice, so replacing a lot of call center functionality using voice interaction. I think we're very close to that in many areas. There's a very wide spectrum of applications.
So, okay, when you were at Citi, you just mentioned you oversaw 80,000 staff. Since now you're talking to all these technology company, AI companies, what do you think in 5 years those 80,000 employees would be reduced to?
Well, it's very interesting. That's very interesting. In my experience at Citi over the course of the 5 years before I left, I think our overall consumer bank went from something like 150,000 staff to about 112, if I recall. I think they're reported numbers for Citi. I think that's quite consistent with the staff reductions that we see at the more progressive financial institutions who are using automation technologies, who are trying to rationalize legacy processes, who are closing unnecessary bank branches, etc. I think we're going to see a continuation of the simplification of financial services businesses, and I think we're going to see very significant impact from digitization and automation generally. Building the automation is one thing. Actually eliminating the legacy processes and costs is another thing altogether.
So for Ping An Group, this automation process, I assume, is also taking place?
Of course.
Could you describe the process right now and also your outlook?
Well, Ping An is extremely advanced and has very good digital platforms across all of its businesses, has done a very good job at allowing a client to access any service from any entry point within its digital offering, has some very good technology for recognition like facial, as an example. In our auto business, we have very good telematics capabilities using mobile phones so that we can identify, whether you're stopping too fast, whether you're braking too fast, whether you're driving on hard roads or dirt roads, whether you're breaking road rules, etc., from speeding or driving on the wrong side of the road, all of that kind of stuff. We can tell all of that stuff now. So we've got quite sophisticated technologies there. We've got pretty good technologies for detecting, car damage, for example, when people call in with a damage report. They can snapshot the damage, and we were able to read that electronically. And in simple cases, we're able to immediately process using technology with minimal human interaction. So that's a very good set of capabilities. These are all going to continue to evolve very rapidly. The great thing about Ping An is we have a very significant internal technology capability, and we're constantly overhauling our systems and our processes to be able to make sure that we're making use of these automation opportunities as they arise.
Well, I guess I'm interested also in this automation process leads to the reduction of total number of employees.
Sure.
So Ping An has 1.2 million insurance retail...
Insurance agents, yeah.
Insurance agents. So, do you see that number reducing by how much?
Well, actually, interestingly, we see the insurance agent as part of our sales capacity still being a very important part of our distribution model. And the issue is less about are we going to replace agents, and the issue is more about how can we continue to use technology to make those agents more productive, to help them segment clients, to help them understand client needs better, and to match our offerings against those needs in a more efficient way.
But some of those applications of this technology will lead to a reduction of...
Some may over time, but I'd say that in the insurance agency area in China, we're still very much in a mode where...
It could grow even.
I think the human element is still quite important in the insurance sales process today.
What about in the back office department? And
of course, we're looking at automation at every level in our business.
Right.
Yes.
Is there an outlook you can provide?
I don't think we've published targets
specifically
for that, but rest assured, Ping An is one of the most forward-thinking companies that I've seen anywhere in the world in regard to how we use technology to drive productivity. So, and of course, our total staff count is a mix of productivity improvements on a continuous basis on the one hand, and very significant continuing growth and expansion on the other. So headcount may well rise. It doesn't mean that we're not achieving productivity. Quite the contrary.
Okay. So now let me ask you about investing in non-Chinese companies as a Chinese investor.
Yes.
How do you think the recipient of Ping An's capital perceive Chinese investors?
I can't speak for all Chinese investors. I can speak for Ping An.
Okay.
And I'd say that Ping An is a very interesting company. I joined Ping An because I was astounded by the breadth of the company's capabilities, the far-reaching vision that Peter Ma has for both the financial services and health sectors, but also for how Ping An can be repositioned essentially as a technology company into the future, how it can use data and how it can use machine learning and artificial intelligence to redefine its existing businesses and create new businesses. When you tell that story to entrepreneurs around the world, they're astounded. And the more you tell them about Ping An's capabilities, the fact that we have 20,000 technology engineers in the company, the fact that we have no legacy systems, there are no mainframe computers at Ping An.
Is this pretty much an education process, you feel?
A lot of it is an education process, because Ping An is very well known in China. It's not very well known internationally. Most people would know it's a large insurance company, but wouldn't know much more than that. Then you tell them about businesses like Lufax or Good Doctor, and the fact that we're a very large traditional financial institution in the one sense, but in the other, we've been able to create new businesses repeatedly. And those are two examples. We have probably 15 more new businesses that are at various stages of incubation and development. And Ping An has created this unique capability to be an incubator of entirely new businesses.
And after this education, do you feel, you know, the recipient of potentially your capital change their mindset about Ping An?
Well, I think in every case I can think of, people are both fascinated but also tremendously impressed by what Ping An has achieved. And particularly when you're talking to entrepreneurs, remember Peter Ma himself started this company in 1988 with 13 people, and every single business that we're in is a business that we started from scratch. Even where we've done acquisitions, they've all been layered into something that was already existing. And you can really tell a story to entrepreneurs internationally about a Chinese entrepreneurial company and a company that understands the process of building a business, that understands entrepreneurship, that understands the need for, you know, leadership, for determination, for the kind of grit that's required to create a significant business in a new space. That's what Ping An does. So actually, you know, it's a very good platform for connecting with entrepreneurs around the world.
Do you feel Chinese capital in general is welcome, or at least thought of as, you know, positively by companies in the US or Europe?
I'd say from the reaction I've received, I'd say our capital is extremely welcome. But I think it's a function of how it's positioned. You know, we approach companies with the attitude that we're here to learn. You know, we're not here to tell you what to do. We're here to take advantage of and to leverage an innovation that you've created as an entrepreneur. We're not here to get in the way. If we're going to get in the way and we're going to destroy value as a consequence of doing that, then it doesn't make sense for us to be working with you. So we want to invest. We want to support you. We want really good partners that can bring value to us. At the same time, we want to and we need to be good partners ourselves. In working with companies that we invest in. I'd say so far, people have been extremely responsive to that approach.
Recently, China banned initial coin offerings, and also the Chinese Central Bank is rumored to be preparing to perhaps issue their own cryptocurrency.
Mm-hmm.
What's your view of cryptocurrency's development in China, and what do you think this, you know, Bitcoin and the likes, what kind of role they're going to play in the future?
Well, I think the whole crypto phenomenon is very interesting. You know, currency is virtual. The world of fiat currencies, forever detached the linkage of a currency to a hard commodity like gold or silver, as we have seen used for centuries in the past as the basis for a currency. I don't think the idea that you can just make up your own currency and expect it to fly as a medium of exchange really makes a lot of sense. I think the way that the global monetary system works today is that central banks are in charge of the supply of money, and I can't see any basis on which responsible central banks would be willing to give up that control. In fact, the control over money supply is indeed the central mission of almost all central banks today with independent mandates.
But do you see that control in the future would include an element of central banks perhaps having their own version of cryptocurrency?
Well, so that raises a separate question. Would it be possible to express central bank issued currencies in the form of an algorithmic currency? And I think the answer there is quite promising, and there's no reason at all why that couldn't be the case. If you think about it today, currency is virtualized. When a bank draws down or places money with a central bank, there's no physical instrument that transfers today. A electronic transaction takes place. What happens actually is an unencrypted transaction takes place, and it's wrapped in an encrypted firewall. A cryptocurrency, if it was an officially issued cryptocurrency, would simply be an inherently encrypted version of exactly the same transaction. I think that will be the future. I think central banks absolutely need to be in control of the standards. I still think, however, we have some way to go to create completely impregnable and completely secure cryptocurrencies that can indeed be the basis of a national currency. Obviously, if you base your national currency on a set of algorithms, then you do so on the premise that those algorithms can never be penetrated. If they could be penetrated, then your currency could be multiplied infinitely without your control, which would basically invalidate the currency. That's going to be the central concern. So getting to the point where we have pretty much absolute certainty as to the impregnability of a currency is going to be critical. We've obviously seen breaches with respect to Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. So I'm sure there's going to be quite a lengthy process from here for central banks to figure out how they can basically insure themselves against those risks.
Has Ping An invested or have taken any actions in the cryptocurrency Bitcoin space?
Not that I'm aware of.
What's the thinking within the group?
Well, I can't answer for the group overall.
Okay.
I can answer for our fund.
Mm-hmm.
And my answer will be based on what I just said, which is that we don't really see the merit of individual companies or individuals creating de novo fiat currencies. Which is the ICO phenomenon. It's an interesting phenomenon to watch. There's obviously some speculative capital that's going after that. We don't see that as a productive avenue for investment for ourselves at this point.
So you don't see in the future people might be able to purchase the insurance policy by using Bitcoin payment?
I think people can already purchase all sorts of things using Bitcoin in many parts of the world. In fact, you could argue in all parts of the world because Bitcoin transactions are available globally. So that is already the case. Now, is that a sustainable basis for a currency? I think I would question that. Would we be interested as a company in participating in a government-issued digital cryptocurrency? Of course we would.
Thank you so much, Jonathan, for your time.
Nina, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.